You know, Jeff Merrick, of all the ways one could choose to cover the controversial return of Matt Cook to Ottawa, the scene of the crime.
Zip.
In all the ways you could possibly think about how to cover a story like this,
yeah.
Where exactly would writing a column involving your penis be on that list?
Wouldn't even enter my mind. That wouldn't even be on my radar at all.
Don Brennan.
That's just me. That's
Don
just me.
Brennan of the
that's
Ottawa me. Sun, a writer who is known to provoke now and again, wrote a column in which he was confronted by Matt Cook about things that he wrote, I believe, over the weekend about Cook. And Cook was not happy with these things that were written about him by Don Brennan. Very accusatory things about his style of play and the kind of player that he is and the things that he did to Erik Karlsson. This is from Don Brennan. And I will do it in a voice that I don't even know if it sounds like Don Brennan. It just seems like I should read it like this.
After listening to Cook answer questions about the February 13th incident in which his skate sliced 70% of the way through Erik Karlsson's Achilles tendon.
70%, by the way, Merrick. Oh, boy. If it had been 65, forget it. No big deal.
Yeah.
70%.
Well, you know why? You know why, Wish?
Why?
Because it cut through the subsock.
All right.
I went to speak with other players in the room about different matters, like every other reporter there. On the way out, I found Cook waiting to have a word in private with me.
Operative word, private.
He wanted to tell me I have no balls.
Honestly, this is a newspaper.
I know.
At first, I think he said small balls, but by the time he had finished and knew that Penguins GM Ray Shiro was listening, he had decided I had none balls. I added that part. Okay. Oh, and I believe he also mumbled something about me having no penis before disappearing into the players only room, which I found interesting.
Why?
Now, I don't know why he found it interesting. I also, personally for me, if someone says I have no penis, I would ask for clarification on that statement. I wouldn't want it to just stay in mumble zone. I'd like to have a little bit of clarification.
I'd be concerned.
Yeah.
I'd be running off to the bathroom and try to count to 21. Pretty
Can
quick.
I tell you something? You're right, because what if Matt Cook knows something that I don't know? For
Wait
example, I'm gonna not to get off on a tangent here, but I was playing with my daughter outside over the weekend. We met a kid in the neighborhood. Long story short, this kid tells me, I shit you not, this kid tells me that he can see the dead. The dead visit him. Okay.
Really?
Yes. Like
I have
he
no
talked about how his
that.
Grandma would used to tickle him, and that he felt tickles from her. Like within 2 days of her passing, he felt the lick of a dog that had died. Right. Jeez. I don't tell you this to freak you out or to derail the show. I tell you this because when you hear something that shocking, you can't help but take a moment and wonder.
Go check.
Does this? Yeah. Kid know something more than I do. Am I, in fact, one of his ghosts? So I bring that up because if someone tells me that I have no penis, I may be concerned, even for a moment, Jeff Merrick.
I'm checking.
That something has happened to it and that this man knows the whereabouts of it.
Yeah. I turn into Captain Pecker Checker right away. I'll be right back. We'll continue this conversation in a moment. I got to go do something first. Maybe on to something.
A captain, no less.
Yes, Captain Beckenbacher. Thank you.
Boy, you keep striving. You keep staying on the straight and narrow, sir. One day you'll be Admiral Pecker Checker.
You know where I get that from? I got that term, actually, a variation of that term. When I was having a conversation once with the Dynamite Kid, Tom Billington.
Whoa.
Because when the WWF was going through the drug testing policy, they'd have an agent who would have to stand there and watch the guys pee into a cup. And, oh, man, you know who was the pecker checker, so to speak, for the Dynamite Kid and for a lot of other guys? Former AWA heavyweight champion Nick Bockwinkel.
I was hoping.
And Dynamite Kid says it's a great delight in pointing out how he used to be champion of the world, and now he's watching me pee.
You know, for those tuning in to the Merrick vs. Wyshynski podcast on this Tuesday, we have gone through a columnist writing about his penis, a kid who has sixth sensibilities to feel the dead tickling him, and a story about the Dynamite Kid's wiener. It's like a fever dream.
Being watched by Nick Bockwinkel.
It's like a fever
dream. This is the vibe we put out. This, like I said yesterday, this is the vibe we put out, Wish.
Don Brennan, okay, which I found interesting. I will not take this opportunity to brag about my manhood.
Oh, there it is.
Ugh.
Oh, man. Didn't we all, hang on, didn't we all give that up in, like, grade school? Like, comparing sizes? Like, who does that? Who says things like that?
Yeah, it's just creepy. You know, and the bottom line is this. If you're going to go down that road with the Penguins, if you're going to be like, you know, talking about bragging about manhood or whatever with the Penguins, I mean, come on now. Do we really need to go there? Douglas Murray is on the team. That's all I'm saying. Douglas Murray landed Tiger's ex.
Tiger's wife's ex, yeah.
That's right. That's all I'm saying. Listen. When I read this column, and Leahy pointed out to me last night that this monstrosity had been written about Matt Cook in the Ottawa Sun, the first thing that struck me about it, Merrick, is why? Why is this here? You know,
hang on. Can I ask you some questions? Because I'm
–
listen, man. I broke into this industry in the most, you know, awkward and fumbled way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was walking the groves of academe, hoping to one day be an English professor. I'd finished my English degree, was going to go on and do my PhD was on the horizon, but I took a summer job at the Fan 590 in promotions, and then just worked my way up to, you know, me talking about the Dynamite Kid peeing in a Dixie cup while an AWA former heavyweight champion Nick Bockwinkel watched.
Dixie cup.
So I didn't go to journalism school, okay? I never went to radio college, TV, none of that. So I have a couple of basic questions that I'd like to ask you about the presence of this piece last night, okay?
Piece, yes.
When a player, okay, as you're taught in school, when a player in this situation, Matt Cook, confronts you to have a one-on-one conversation, is that automatically an off-the-record conversation? Or does that give you an opportunity to use your platform and your pulpit as a way to get back at that player for confronting you one-on-one? Essentially, what I'm asking you, Wish, is in that situation, what's the protocol? Because Cook confronted Don Brennan one-on-one. Is that considered on the record or off the record?
I think any time an athlete speaks with a reporter and the reporter doesn't say this is off the record or whatever, or that it's established, you assume it's on the record, right?
Okay.
The thing that happened with Cook and Brennan, there's sort of a, you know, if you're someone who takes your shots at people, you should be willing to allow them retort, right? And in that case, Brennan wrote stuff about Cook over the weekend. This was Cook's chance to retort. And typically, what's said in a situation like that is not going to wind up in a column. It's not going to wind up on the radio. It's not going to wind up in the public forum, because there's a notion of, okay, this is man to man. I said my piece, you say your piece, and then we're done with it. When it does emerge from the locker room is in two cases. One, when the reporter unfortunately becomes the story, and that's usually a case where somebody's getting called out in public. And by that I mean Larry Brooks does not go into every scrum with John Tortorella looking to become the story, okay? John Tortorella makes him the story a lot of times. So then it's unavoidable to have to write about that or address it. And the other time is if you choose to use this for your own benefit, to make an example out of somebody, to pump your own tires, to make yourself the story. And that's what Brennan did. Brennan built a column around his confrontation with Matt Cook, and did it in an infantile and stupid way. And just came off as an embarrassment through it.
It was funny because a lot of the tweets last night that I saw, you know, some of the more profound ones were, I can't believe the Ottawa Sun just made Matt Cook a sympathetic figure. Just made him a sympathetic character.
But the bottom line is this. It's one of those situations where you use your best judgment. You know, am I going to exacerbate a situation? Because here's the thing. Usually when a situation like this goes down, it's not with somebody you don't cover, right? It's usually someone you cover that you're going to have words with. And then you have to figure out what the politics are. Can I be public about this? Do I need to soothe the relationship? Is this guy always going to be an asshole to me? Do I take him out? If I take him out, what does that mean for my other relationships on this team? That's from the beat, right? But Cook's not on Brennan's beat. Cook's the enemy. He's an enemy combatant. So Brennan's going to torch him no matter what without any repercussions. So there's a lot of things that kind of go into it, but the bottom line is this. You don't air your laundry like that. You take a shot, he takes a shot, it's done. And then if you want to talk about it one day, talk about it in a book down the line. Don't put it in the paper the next day. It's stupid. It's not breaking a journalistic code, but you just come off as petty. Because you know what you're doing now? You took your shot, he took your shot. Oh, he said mean things about my penis. Well, now I'm going to take another shot because I have a bully pulpit. It's immature. It's childish.
How many times have players taken runs at you?
I've been run at. Well, okay, I've gotten the you haven't played the game so you don't know thing a few times. I've run into serious interference a couple times with stuff that Dimitri did for us. On from a player's perspective, because sometimes he gets things out of these Russian guys that their teammates don't want to hear. One that Dmitry, I think, has talked about is Sergei Fedorov went after us for the Semin interview. When Puck Daddy first started doing these things and Semin called Sidney Crosby dead wood, Fedorov tore our asses off. I mean, it just killed us in the locker room one day for it. You know, saying it was out of context and all this other jive. And of course, I will say that I've had more problems with the league behind the scenes than I have had with players. But you take your lumps, and this is going back to high school days too, man. When I was covering high school sports for the paper, you take your lumps. You're always going to have someone who says that you're not qualified to cover X, and because you never did Y, and whether it's you didn't play hockey or you've never run cross country or you've never had a concussion or any of this stuff, and you know. I don't know. There are some cases where that's probably the right take, and there are some cases where that's the wrong take. Like I said in the post about the Duncan Keith thing, which we're going to talk about in a bit with the one reporter from Vancouver, it's not as if anyone ever says that a science reporter can't write about the rover because they've never been to Mars. You know?
Well, and it's also like saying, you know, I don't have to jump in front of a subway train to know that it's not going to tickle if I do.
Right. Right.
Right. It's like I always want to – the authenticity card is such a tricky one because the standard one that I usually always fire back with is well, have you ever had – let me ask you this. Okay. Greg, have you ever had a bad meal?
Yes.
Oh, really? When were you a chef? Where did you study? Tell me where you graduated from.
Yeah. You know?
Like the authenticity card is a tricky one to play. We'll get into it when we talk about the Karen Thompson situation as well because I maintain that – there's no one who understands the game. There's no one who, capital U, understands anything. We're all on a various sort of ladder rung of understanding. We'll get to it a little bit later on. Yeah. But the authenticity card, to me, is always a phony one to play. And it's usually played as your last card, and it's a desperate one.
You need the
Hail Mary pass, and you need the home run swing. Because, you know, it's bottom of the ninth, and you're the last duck standing there.
And that's exactly what happened in the Keith situation, which we'll get to in a second. Last thing on Cook is, I've said this before on the podcast, and I'll keep saying it until people stop doing it. Please stop debating, dissecting, demeaning a player that doesn't exist anymore. Like, I'm sorry, but, like, Mike Milbury is still taking runs at Matt Cook over shit he did 2 years ago. He's not the same guy. Like, could we stop arguing about Matt Cook as being this scurrilous bastard? He's not anymore. The Carlson thing was an accident. Oh dear. He low bridged a hit on Adam McQuaid. Whoa. Let's convene a grand jury. Never seen that in a hockey game this season.
I think part of, and I'm going to get all, you know, psychoanalytical here, but I think part of where Milbury's coming from in that, you know, refusing to let go of who Matt Cook used to be is, tell me exactly who has given Mike Milbury a pass for how he acted when he was general manager of the Islanders. He still gets that every single day, right? So Mike Milbury understands that nobody is to be forgiven for what they've done. Nobody gets a free pass anymore, and your history. What's that line in Magnolia? You may be done with history, but history's not done with you. And I think that's kind of the baggage that Mike still brings along with him wherever he goes. And that's probably why he has a hard time letting go of who Matt Cook was. I got no problem letting go with who Matt Cook was. Obviously, you're the same way. Many people listening to this podcast are the same way, unless you live in Ottawa. And then you put up wanted posters all over the rink
Two things about that. First off, Magnolia was terrible.
It's my least favorite Tom Cruise role, other than Born on the 4th of July.
We'll talk about that on another show. Remember, everybody, file it away for going postal next week. Tom Cruise movies and the great Tom Cruise debate. So secondly, though, is I know what you're saying about Milbury, and I think there might be some truth to it. But the bottom line about Mike Milbury is if you're going to prosecute and persecute Matt Cook based on reputation, you have to eventually own up to the fact that you endorsed the hit on Mark Savard. March 2010, Mike Milbury on Boston radio. The word predatory does come to mind, and you know, I don't have any trouble with that. When you're playing hockey, you're supposed to finish your checks. I don't think he meant to give him a grade 2 concussion. That's Matt Cook's game. He's supposed to be a guy that finishes his checks, that agitates a little bit, that can play a little bit of hockey. He's not a slug, but he's not Sidney Crosby. His job is to make sure he punishes people when he gets the opportunity. Intent to injure? I don't know. That's a hard one to pin on anybody. Certainly ready to finish his check with authority. Again, I'm fine with Mike Milbury changing his stripes because he's come around in concussions. He's come around in a lot of this physicality stuff. We talked about this on the show before, and kudos to him for doing that. But we do not sit there and talk about Matt Cook as being this criminal, as being this thug, as being this injurious bastard. Why is it okay for Mike Milbury to change but Matt Cook can't?
Yeah.
That's the point.
I understand that. Mike's one of the more interesting figures in media right now because as we're seeing it, and you know what, and I'm kind of that way as well because I'm having a hard time, and I have had a hard time post-2005 lockout coming to grips with what this game is, what it's becoming, and where it's going. That, you know, all under the umbrella of the clash of what I would want it to be. But I can't force this thing on anybody. I just have to sort of accept what I can't change. But Mike's a fascinating story because somewhere in there, like Mike's been being pulled in a couple of different directions. You know, the weight of everything he grew up knowing about hockey and how you're supposed to play it versus the way this game is evolving and Mike knowing that he needs to adapt to it because he still needs to exist in this environment. Namely, he still needs a job in media. Like, there are a lot of people that leave the game and they turn into grumpy hockey guys. I don't like the way the game is right now. The game stinks. Forget it. I'm never going to go watch this thing again. And then you just stop caring and you stop evolving. And then hockey becomes part of your rearview mirror and it's no longer part of your life. But Mike knows that this is still very much a part of who he is. And so there is that constant struggle that I think Milbury's going through, which is the weight of the past versus the expectation of the future. It is a fascinating thing to watch play out on NBC every time he's on. Because honestly, I don't know what he's going to say. I don't know which Mike Milbury is going to appear. The one who's still married a little bit more to his big old Boston Bruins bad boys days, or the one who's trying to evolve and change with the game and keep himself relevant in it. He may be the Dos Equis man in the NHL right now. He may be the most fascinating man in the world. He may be that guy. The most interesting man in hockey media might be Mike Milbury.
He doesn't call Matt Cook a slug. He only calls him a skunk. All right. With that, we are going to get to. We got Helene St. James coming up to talk about the Detroit Red Wings and other
Helena
matters.
Helena St. James. With, say it right. Say it.
I'm
right.
Sorry. Did I say Helene
St. James.
Jesus Christ. I'm sorry.
I'm thinking Helene Elliott. Helena St. James.
Yeah, I think I know, and that's my fault. I'm sorry. With that, let's start the show proper, shall we?
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
We're going to get corner offices out of this one for sure, Greg. Right away, your BS detector should go off. Why do I know this crap? What's wrong with me? Are you in? insane.
And Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
You and I are not quite that dissimilar.
La 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 la, hockey, hockey, hockey.
Seattle is playing excellent defense these days.
What does that even mean?
Debate hockey.
So much junior hockey knowledge in that big juicy brain.
Oh, yeah.
Pop culture.
See, I kind of look at our podcast here like Jazz Odyssey.
There's some bloggers that are great, that are entertaining, that are factual. It's fabulous.
Damn right, JD.
And more hockey.
Just what we need to shoot off the side of the barn. That's how I developed my wrist shot, shooting frozen cow patties in Lloydminster.
Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Merrick versus Wyshynski, huh?
All right.
Bow, bow, bow.
All right, let's hit the audio from last night. This is, of course, if you don't know what happened, Duncan Keith, after the Blackhawks lost to the Vancouver Canucks last night, confronted by Karen Thompson, a reporter for Vancouver's Team 1040, I believe it is, yes, talking about a slash to the back of Daniel Sedin, right as Sedin scored a goal last night. Some controversy as to whether or not it was going to be a penalty. I believe the referee's arm was going up when Sedin scored, so that would negate any power play. Yep. But a slash to the back sort of went under the radar, to, you know, whatever you want to call it, and they had this back and forth after the game.
Yeah, it's the only time, really, that you've lost by more than one goal all season. Is there anything you chalked it up to, or is it just an all-time?
I would just chalk
it
up
full,
to...
This is the full audio, by the way.
Getting outworked.
It's right got now. A bunch of other crap on it.
Just a second here. Let me get a
So that's going to go on for a little bit.
Get in trouble.
I wonder who that is.
Trying to get in trouble.
No idea. So we could talk over this part.
It up to get no work, by the way. Skated, and you know, right from the first.
Remember when he didn't have any teeth?
There, they always skated.
That was kind of cool. Remember when he had like no teeth that knocked him out in the game?
Was able to keep it
in the playoffs with Jonathan Tate.
We took too many penalties, so overall, it was a bad game.
Oh yeah, for sure. It all should have been Jonathan Tate.
Surprised by that connection.
Jonathan
Tate.
I'm not surprised by it. I'm disappointed, but
Jonathan Tate deserved the con. I mean, the real issue. Well, the real issue is that Pronger deserved
the tank feeling going into the playoffs.
Yeah, maybe.
Sorry?
But they didn't win.
I would have given it to
going into the playoffs.
I think
just
the
few guys remaining.
I would feel good. Obviously, we're not happy about tonight. We know we
he
need
does
to play
sound like
more
a guy with no teeth
tonight, and we know
still,
we're confident.
Yeah,
it's one game that we're not happy with, but we know what we're capable of doing in this room.
Do you ever wish audio files had starting points where you could just kind of hit a button and go to exactly where you need to be?
No, obviously disappointing tonight.
That too.
You wanted the whole version. We had a 19-second one, and you wanted the whole thing.
Well, I didn't. You know what? Hit pause on this. Hit pause on this.
Hold on. This is it.
Oh, that's it? Okay, go. All right.
Yeah, okay. Go. Here we go. Yeah.
Happy about tonight, and we know we're confident. It's one game that you know, we're not happy with, but we know what we're capable of doing in this room, and it's just a matter of sticking with it, staying positive. It's you know, obviously disappointing tonight. It's a big game, but you know, we weren't skating very good tonight.
Can you talk about what happened after the Daniel Sedin goal?
You can show me that one.
Third goal.
Third one. Well, we scored one goal after that, I think, and then
right
the game ended 3-1.
Right,
what did he?
Right after
he scored. I went off the ice and took a minus.
Okay.
I don't know. What are you talking about?
Okay, just checking.
What did you see?
Well, there was some, there looked like maybe there was a penalty that went undetected. You seemed a bit frustrated.
Oh no, I don't think there was. I think he scored a nice goal, and that's what the ref was right there. That's what the ref saw. We should get you as a ref, maybe, hey?
Yeah, maybe.
First female referee. You can't play, probably, either, right? But you're thinking the game, like, you know what?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, see ya.
Joining us now on the line, someone overqualified to be the first female referee in the National Hockey League. She is Helena St. James of the Detroit Free Press. How are you joining us here in the Merrick vs. Wyshynski podcast?
Well, it's interesting. I was going to sit down and write my notebook for tomorrow, but instead I'm barefoot in my kitchen baking cookies for the guys because apparently my ovaries get in the way of doing my job.
Don't you know your breasts get in the way of writing, for crying out loud? Jeez.
Oh, man, that was a rough one last night, isn't it? I mean, I think, you know, I we've all gotten the you've never played the game thing, but the extra icing on the cupcake, as it were, with the female referee thing definitely was over the line, yes?
Yeah, and, you know, I think it's interesting because you hear how quickly he cuts the interview off. I think he realized oops, I should have closed my mouth. And to me, that's what it sounds like, that he realizes he probably just went a couple words too far. You know, I mean, he probably was upset more than anything. I'd like to think that's not how he feels. I think it's certainly not the first time we've heard that argument, but it's a silly and specious argument, you know, to say that no one should be allowed to. He'd put a lot of people out of work, I think, if that was his opinion. I mean, you know, should we dismiss, so no one but another U.S. president should be allowed to be the moderator at presidential debates? I mean, you can just go on and on if that's your train of logic, so.
Yeah, we talked about the authenticity card a lot over the program, and we'll continue to do so before the show is over. You know, we also talked about the Matt Cook incident with Brennan in Ottawa as well. From your point of view, I'm curious, when a player confronts you about something that you wrote or something that you said one-on-one, do you consider that to be an on-the-record conversation or an off-the-record conversation?
I try to make sure I clarify with a player, you know, and it's easier for me now. I mean, I've covered the Red Wings for a number of years, but if there's any doubt, you know, I think it's the onus is on both sides to iron it out. Is it on the record or off the record? And I certainly think in this day and age, if I were the one being interviewed, I wouldn't say it into an iPhone or a tape recorder or a camera. I would say, you know, this is off the record and make sure anything electronic is shut off first, especially if you don't know the person that well. You know, and just be careful in general. I mean, if you're doubtful about saying something, maybe don't say it. But it should be established whether something is on or off the record.
Do you think the media has become too confrontational? I mean, there's always this notion that the sort of ESPNization of the sports media, you know, watching Skip Bayless take runs at athletes on a morning show has trickled down to other forms of media. Do you think that we're too confrontational in 2013?
I think it's interesting how the media has evolved, right? Because everybody is so eager to have something first. I mean, we saw last week with CNN completely getting it wrong with a suspect in the Boston Marathon bombing, you know, misreporting there. I mean, people are so eager to have something first. And certainly I think the media has become a much bigger part of the story. I mean, the golden rule used to be don't be a part of the story, but much more, you know, I think with the influx of bloggers and such, that it's become a completely different scenario now. And I think a lot of times, you know, there's just a hugely blurred line between who is a neutral reporter, who is a columnist, who is a TV person or, you know, just a radio shock host. And it may be hard for players to find out. You know, I think the other thing, I mean, I've covered a lot of NBA as well. And to me, NHL guys, 99% of them are the salt of the earth. You know, I mean, I think maybe part of the reason there's so much attention to what Duncan Keith said is because it's so unusual.
And I do wonder too, because I'm a cut someone's a lot of slack kind of guy, Helena. How much slack do you cut someone specifically after a loss? And you're right, most times the guys are fine. They can suck it up for the little while the reporters are in there so the reporters can get what they need to get their pieces done for the evening. But every now and then someone does sort of go off script and reacts as if, listen, I'm angry and I'm not going to be shy about it and I'm going to let everyone know how I feel. How much slack do you cut? Now, maybe not necessarily Duncan Keith, but a player who after a loss is angry, is emotional, and that's reflected in the answers that he gives you.
I think it depends on, you know, the rapport you have with a player. If it's somebody in the Detroit Red Wings dressing room, I probably cut them a lot more slack because, you know, we see each other every day and know each other. And, you know, sometimes there's a tendency to take things out on people you know and expect to let it go. If it had been a situation with a player from another team, I think it would have been far more taken aback because it's misdirection on their part, you know, which I think you have to recognize that they're angry about something else. And that's immature. That's like, you know, when people at airports take things out on gate agents. Well, it's not the gate agent's fault that there's a snowstorm, you know. I mean, direct your anger. And I think that's part of maturity on the person who's upset is to make sure you take it out on the right person. And maybe that person last night were the Blackhawks themselves.
Yeah, but let's say there was a mechanical error, and then you got really mad at the gate agent. Maybe like, I don't know, I did last, forget it. So
that's when you find the nearest bar that serves Bud Light Lime, right?
Yeah, I was terrible. I freely admit it. But the good thing for you is that you haven't really had to cover all that many catastrophic losses for the Detroit Red Wings, being that they've been in the playoffs for 21 straight seasons, which brings us to the Red Wings themselves. Three assists for Zetterberg last night, a very Red Wings-esque victory over Phoenix, frustrating them, 4-0 win, looking very much like the team we expect them to be. Can that be a pivot for them? Can that be the one that kind of gets them rolling and has them close out the season and hopping back over the Blue Jackets for the 8th seed?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because for the most part, they've played down to their opponent. I mean, I know Columbus is above them now, but two of their most awful games of the season came in March, in early March, when Columbus was far below them in the standings. So for the Wings, you know, to not take the Coyotes lightly and to play as well as they did last night, because, you know, they spent half of Sunday traveling home from Vancouver and their body clocks were still in Pacific time. So I think it was a mental toughness victory for them. And far more so than Sutterberg getting three assists, to me the significant parts were two goals, although one of them an empty netter from Johan Franzén, who's been playing far better for the past month, and that Valtteri Foppula was actually shooting the puck. I think it stuns opponents because they aren't used to seeing that from him. To me, Foppula is such a huge part or key to their success, and it's just incredibly frustrating watching him, a guy who's got so much skill, and he just doesn't do enough out there. I mean, he had one goal in 16 games before last night. There's so much more skill in him. If they can get more out of him this past week like he played last night, they'll be in good shape. I still think they'll make the playoffs. You know, Minnesota may sink out of it, for that matter. Yeah. It may not just be can they leapfrog Columbus. So.
Yeah, it's on the Philpola goal. He had another chance in front too, but he was stopped by Mike Smith. I watched the replay of that during Hockey Central last night, and I keep trying to find where the area he had to shoot. Like, if you want to talk about scoring a perfect goal where you had zero amount of space to shoot at, that was that Valtteri Foppula goal yesterday.
Right. You know, so you see, I mean, he's got great vision, and he's got a much, much better shot. And, yeah, you know, he's a creative player, so like Pavel Datsyuk, he'll probably look to pass first. But there are so many times, especially on the power play, when he should take the shot and he doesn't. And, you know, this is a guy who's looking for $5 million going into his new contract next year. And the Wings, they really want to keep him because they're worried Pavel Datsyuk will leave at the end of next year when his contract is up. But, you know, the Foppula they saw last night is definitely worth $5 million a season, but the one who's been around for most of the season is barely worth $4 million. So they kind of have to decide which guy is going to show up.
The streak being on the line for these guys, is it more of a motivator, or has it added a significant amount of pressure to being on the bubble right now?
I think it's both. You know, I mean, I don't think Mike Babcock makes a good point, you know, that Henrik Zetterberg doesn't want it to be on his first watch as captain that they missed the playoffs. Now, in my opinion, they've put themselves in a very precarious position by, you know, some awful, awful performances. I mean, they were in Phoenix a few weeks ago and just basically, I mean, they did less than we did in the press box in the second period. They were just standing around watching Jimmy Howard make save after save. It was disgraceful. And you wonder, like, so do they really want it, you know? And, you know, but then they play, I mean, and they played a great game Saturday night in Vancouver as well. They just couldn't convert anything, but they played really, really well. So, you know, it'll be telling last few games until they're eliminated. I don't believe they're going to be in it.
First period yesterday, I thought Phoenix carried the balance of the play, but Jimmy Howard kept the team in it, and you should never be embarrassed to have a good goaltender on your squad. He is, after all, part of your team. Your thoughts on Jimmy Howard so far this season?
I think he's been their MVP. I really do. I mean, he's had a few bad outings here and there, but if you look at every game period by period, I've lost track of how many periods he's been the reason that they've had a chance to win. I mean, they've went through a stretch where they just were so sluggish in every single start to the game, and he kept them in there until they got their legs skating and kind of took over. I mean, he's a huge part of the reason that they're in the, even, you know, within spitting distance of the playoffs. And, you know, now the entire workload is him, because unfortunately for the Wings, the Jonas Gustafsson experiment really went south. I mean, the coaching staff really has no confidence in him. I doubt we'll see him even Thursday night, second of a back-to-back against the, you know, Predators, who aren't even in the playoffs. I don't think we'll see him again. He may be somebody that they consider, you know, using a compliance buyout on over the summer, but Jimmy Howard has been very, very strong in net and has been an absolute workhorse for them.
Real quick, because I understand you got to go. From the elite teams that we see in this conference, the Western Conference, Chicago, Anaheim, Vancouver now all securing the top three seeds. L.A. also playoff team. They've clinched as well. Of those four, is there one that you think stands out above the rest? Is Chicago the real deal?
Oh, I think so by far. I think Chicago will smoke whoever they get in the first round. I think for the Wings, it would be far more favorable if they could get into the seventh spot and play Anaheim. They had good success in Anaheim 2 games in a row in March. I don't think Anaheim's defense is nearly as intimidating as Chicago's. To me, I'd be very, very surprised if Chicago doesn't show up in the Stanley Cup final.
Wow, right. There you go.
On that, we'll let you go. You got to hustle. Helena, thanks so much for stopping by, as always. Always appreciate your time.
Anytime.
There she is. From the Detroit Free Press, and you should follow her on Twitter as well. What is her Twitter handle? Let me find that for you. It is Helena St. James, H-E-L-E-N-E, although pronounced Helena, S-T James on Twitter. Follow that woman. Everything you need to know about the Detroit Red Wings. You know what I saw last night from the Red Wings? And I haven't
What's
seen
that?
This very often at all this season. You know how traditionally, you know, with Zetterberg and Lidstrom and Datsyuk and Rafalski and all the guys, they've been able to hypnotize teams where you find that everybody on the ice is looking at the guy with the puck and they're just sort of admiring the beautiful plays that Detroit's putting together. That was last night.
Yeah.
It was maybe the first time that I've seen it all season long, the way that Detroit hypnotized the Phoenix Coyotes yesterday. It's fascinating to watch when it happens. Like if you look, I mean, the entire game, when you break it right down, because I understand the game apparently, when you break down hockey, a lot of it is just all about gap control, right? It's a gap control game. And the gap yesterday was huge between Detroit and Phoenix. And that allowed them to make, you know, beautiful, long, gorgeous, hypnotizing, long passes. Phoenix was just dead from, well, the first period they were good, but from the second period on, they were just awful because they were standing around watching the Detroit. They became hockey fans in the middle of a game, essentially is what I'm saying.
Three power play goals obviously helps a little bit as well, including a dagger.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the other thing, too. They scored a dagger of a goal at the end of the first period. You know, 2-0 down to the Detroit Red Wings after one period at the Joe, and you're looking at a pretty steep hill to climb.
If anyone can tell me where that saying, I've been saying it for years, and I don't know where it comes from, and I don't know where I started, how I picked it up. But if someone can tell me the etymology of the term cob, meaning nothing, if you could pass it along, I'd be greatly appreciative, because I have no idea. I've just been saying cob pretty much my whole life. Two cob. I think you call it goose, right? Three goose.
Yeah, I say goose. Yeah.
Yeah. I say cob. I don't know where it comes from.
Section 328 writes in, tell me what part of life isn't about gap control. Fair point.
Hey.
Come on.
Yeah.
Question of the day is related to the Duncan Keith thing. And it's a good question, and we're getting a lot. I mean, we're getting just a shit ton of responses for this, actually. So we'll try to get to as many as we can along with various century playoff stuff. Do you have to play hockey to understand it? Simple as that. Do you have to play hockey? Do you have to have played the game to understand it? PuckDaddyBlog@yahoo.com, @Wyshynski, @JeffMerrick on Twitter, #MVSW. Do you have to play hockey to understand the game?
No.
Well,
no.
Yeah. Well,
here's my thing about
it.
I don't think anybody understands the game. I think there are some people that understand elements of the game better than others, but understanding the capital G game, I think, is impossible. One, because it's always changing, and B, because you know how long this game has been played, and how many different areas that you never would have thought of, that you never would have considered. That all of a sudden you stumble across it on one day, whether you're looking back in a historical piece, or you're looking forward, you're talking to someone. I don't think that there's anybody that understands the game better than anybody else. I think there are people that understand elements of it better than other people. I think that I understand the history of the game better than many NHLers who play right now.
Boy, howdy.
At the same time, you know, all those guys, as far as power play formation and, you know, breakout patterns and, you know, flush the boards and Peterborough freeze and all these types of things can give me a pretty good schooling on what the game is about. So until we define sort of what the game means, I don't really think that anybody knows. No one is the ultimate authority, okay? Or to get all, you know, post-structuralist on you, the transcendental signifier, if I can borrow from Jacques Derrida and Michel Foucault, the one who knows everything about all. There's no one. We all understand a different element of the game. You know, I'll tell you what.
Yeah.
This morning on the way to the gym, you know who I talked to?
Who?
I talked to Ian Clark. You know who Ian Clark is? He's a goaltending coach for the Columbus Blue Jackets. So I was saying to myself last night, I want to learn more about Sergei Bobrovsky. I want to know how this guy is different from when he was in Philadelphia, what this guy is all about. So I texted with Ian Clark last night, and we talked this morning on the way into the shop, and he told me some things that I had never considered about goaltending, just about backing up on the rush and how much room you want to give and what happens to your movement when you make a commitment and how you play posts specifically and what the difference is in playing in different situations and how you control your body as a goaltender to look big and to look small. And Ian was talking about how when Bobrovsky came over from Philadelphia, he was a big goaltender who made himself look too small in different situations. Dude, in a 15-minute conversation on the way to the gym, I learned a ton about net mining that I didn't know as of last night. Everybody's always learning. Everybody's always understanding. So for someone to flippantly say, you don't understand the game, nobody understands the game. No, I don't. You don't. You listening? No, you don't either. Duncan Keith, you don't. All right? Helena St. James, you don't understand it. Karen Thompson, you don't understand it. None of us understand the game. And that's part of the beauty of it, because you can always learn more about it.
My first reaction whenever I get the you never played the game counter argument is that I agree with you in a way that none of us understand the game. And I say that because if I ever get that from somebody who's just trying to slag on me for being an American writer who sucks at hockey, the person that's saying that is usually never been in the National Hockey League. None of us have played the game on this level. None of us have. We don't understand the speed. We don't understand the physicality. We don't understand what it's like to get hit by a 6'9" man giant into the turnbuckle. We don't understand any of this stuff.
Turnbuckle, yeah. And you know what we don't understand? We don't understand that life of an athlete on the road.
Yeah.
An elite level athlete, one of the best, you know, one of the best 700 players in his field on the road 82 games a year.
We don't even understand what it's like to be 20 years old and a multimillionaire. We don't understand that either. We don't understand any of this stuff. But here's the thing that I do think I agree with the you've never played the game people, okay? I don't think it's mandatory to cover this game, love this game, appreciate this game, to have played the game. That said, I do think that you get a better understanding for the stamina involved. You get a better understanding for the physicality. You get a better understanding for the speed, for the pain, getting hit with a puck. There's a lot of things that you can glean from... Yeah, from playing the game that will benefit you as a fan and as a writer. That doesn't disqualify you though from either if you don't play the game. That's my point. And that's an important facet of this whole thing is this notion that like you don't have a level of understanding about why a penalty was or wasn't called because you've never played the game. It's asinine. It's completely asinine.
That's true. But coming back to my original point, I think the point that you're making as well, by having played the game, there are things you can glean from it that guys like you and me just can't because we've never played in that environment. Like one of the great lessons from this year, one of the most interesting lessons from this year, you know, you always look for reasons why the Washington Capitals are an improved team, for example. And you look at their head coach, and man, he felt it. And he felt it on this podcast, and he felt it elsewhere about, you know, the team's having a tough time adjusting to what Adam Oates wants to do. But Adam Oates, I mean, the ultimate perfectionist, okay? Like he everything buttoned down and to a T, wants everything to perfection. And this one thing I'm going to tell you is probably is only something you can understand or even initiate on your team if you've played the game. Adam Oates is so much of a perfectionist and so much of a stickler. You know what he had done to the Washington Capitals this year, Wish? I don't know if it's all the players, but some of the players, he had them change the curves on their stick. That's how that minute a detail. You know what? This curve isn't working for the player that you are. Here's what we need you to be. This is too much of a heel curve, too much of a toe curve. This is not going to help you on your backhand. You're too predictable with a big banana curve. Goaltenders know you're never going to go backhand because you can't get the puck up with that curve. Change the curve on your stick. I think you only get something like that if you've played the game.
Right.
But as far as appreciating the game and observing the game, and you can still get that from not having played the game. But there are still plenty of things you can't get if you haven't played the game.
Yeah. And I think gear is really a point of separation, right? Like
that is,
you know,
for sure.
You get into the visor debate. Like you've never played a full 60 minutes with a visor on, you can't really opine on whether or not it's good or bad for a guy's peripheral vision. You know what I mean? That's yeah, when you defer. And that's the thing. Like, you know, people who read me know that I clearly suck at hockey. I haven't played hockey on a consistent basis ever. When I played, it was here or there. It was in the street usually when I grew up in Jersey. But I'm a student. And I try to learn. I try to talk to people that are smarter than me to help learn the game better. And that's the best I can do. When Bourne wrote for us, he was great because Bourne played the game. His dad played the game. He's got hockey in his blood. And you could mm-hmm. ask him 1,000 questions about hockey, and he's going to be able to answer them. And I think he'd be a great coach one day because of that. But it's a big umbrella, and that's the point. Like, it goes back to what you were saying before. Like, I don't understand why you can't have people in the media that have experience. You can't have people with the media that are simply just learning on the fly, bringing a different perspective. Because you know what? The bottom line is that you're serving a multitude of audiences. And the majority of people that approach this game are going to relate more to someone who's approaching it through their eyes than someone who's approaching it through expert eyes. And that's why sometimes when you get into these having played the game conversations, it can get kind of wonky. Get over your head a little bit. And sometimes it's better to bring it down to a level where, okay, you're approaching this game the same way I did, as a fan, as someone who grew up appreciating it, playing here and there, versus going over my head with systems and stuff.
You know who's made me think about the game in a profoundly challenging way?
I know who you're going to say.
Ellen Etchingham.
Absolutely.
And you know when she started watching hockey? Like, what, 2008?
Mm-hmm.
Read her writing. Yeah, well, folks, if you've never read Ellen Etchingham, go out of your way. Go out of your way to read Ellen Etchingham.
And she's a great example of someone who I think has admitted that having played the game has opened her eyes to a multitude of things about the game she didn't realize before.
She's learning how to – I think she's got 2 years under her belt now. I remember the piece she wrote when she scored her first goal. And that's one of the beautiful things about hockey too. And that's one of the things that's lost on guys like me, hack men's league hockey players. I used to teach a beginner's hockey school for adults, mainly women, but some guys in there as well. And I remember it as a kid, and you see it in the faces of beginner adults. The first time you have a first, the first time you take a hard pass, the first time you raise the puck, the first time you stayed onside on a rush, and the first time you scored a goal. All those feelings are gone. All those first feelings are gone for me. That was the biggest thrill, was teaching those beginner classes to see the thrill of I just had a first in hockey, because all my firsts are gone. Pretty much, you know, maybe you're the same listening right now on this podcast. Maybe all of your hockey firsts are gone, but maybe they're not. And if you've ever wanted to try playing hockey, do what Etchingham did. Just start. Just start and start to have your firsts, because you're never too old to start it. It's a game that if you stay healthy, you can play your entire life. Honestly, there are men's and women's leagues you can play right up until you take the dirt nap. It's a fantastic game.
And the bottom line for anybody in the media is that, you know what? Some days you're going to be able to cover running. We've all run. We know what it's like. We can feel the air coming in and out of our lungs, and we can feel the burn after a while. And then some days you cover water polo, and you realize why I've never played water polo. In fact, I believe I might drown playing water polo because there's a guy pushing my head underwater, and I'm not a very strong swimmer. So all of these things are part of the gig. And you never played the game argument is always bullshit to me, because it's not about having played it. It's about understanding it, appreciating it, and always trying to learn. Always trying to
learn
about it.
You know when that really hit home for me was when I went to Beijing in 2008 to cover the games. Because you know which sports that I covered? I covered judo, which is a little bit of. I covered table tennis. We've all played ping pong. But the others, like I covered modern pentathlon. I covered shooting. I covered 3-meter springboard diving. Like, what, archery, like rowing. When have I ever done any of these things? Never. But you do your homework. You do your studying. You can't appreciate it like the athletes can, but I think you can still understand it on a very base level.
I will say this, at no point in my time in London did somebody competing in competitive equestrian trot up to me on their horse and say, well, you've never jumped over a steeple.
You're the guy from Puck Daddy. What could you possibly know about equestrian?
Jake Greenland writes in, getting some of the multitude of emails and tweets that we've gotten about this. No, you don't have to have played to be able to understand it. Think about Gretzky or Richard. Understand the game. Can't teach or coach it. Personally, I've never committed any federal offense. I do, however, understand what's going on as I've studied and written on criminology and social work for years now. Exactly. You don't have to commit a crime in order to cover crime.
Hold on a second.
Paul...
As a quick aside.
Yeah.
Jim Beanowich. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. How long until Captain Peckerchecker gets his own Twitter account now?
Exactly. Exactly.
Sorry. Back to the question of the day.
Eric Morris, do you have to play hockey to understand it? I would say yes, but video games like NHL 13, etc., really help a lot of people to understand the strategy of the game if they haven't played. Now, that's a very interesting viewpoint because I have a guy who emails me whenever I write about the EA Sports series and says, all you do is play video games. You'd never play hockey. You don't understand the game. I would argue that those who play hockey video games, any sports video game, do understand the basics. You can learn it. A kid can learn hockey playing the EA Sports series.
Yeah, I always wonder where the inspiration and the learning comes from quote unquote non-traditional hockey markets, where like if you live in a market where there's like one rink, you know. I had that experience when I taught at a hockey school in northern Israel a couple of summers ago, and I said to these kids, like, there's one rink, the Canadian Center, right on the border of Lebanon, and they could basically play for an hour, maybe 2 hours every week. But they're pretty good for their, you know, skill set and level. They're pretty good hockey players. And you know what a lot of them told me where they learn how to play the game or they learn how to understand the game? Video games.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first time I'd ever heard anyone say video games taught me how to play hockey, because I and all my friends just kind of grew up playing hockey, and video games was something we did, or hockey video games, something we just did as, you know, something else to do that involved hockey, and was fun playing video games. I never thought for a second it could be didactic. It could teach you anything about hockey. But there I was saying, yeah, I guess they can teach you about hockey.
Nicole Henry writes in, to me, hockey is like any other job. If you observe or read enough about it enough, yes, you can understand it to a certain extent. Actively taking part can help extend that knowledge so you may speak with more intelligently on the subject. Where hockey may be unique is the bonding that occurs while on the job that may lead to certain codes or unwritten rules which the layman may never understand because they haven't played. That's a great point. That's an excellent
point.
You know, and the best we can do is read the code by Ross Bernstein or whatever his name was. Who's that cat who wrote the code?
Ross Bernstein.
Was it Bernstein? Get him. Glad I didn't screw up his name. This is from
That's a great point too. And I know I repeat stories a lot and facts and things, but I've always believed that for this podcast, Wish, if we can bring one thing every day that someone who's listened from day one, or maybe we just picked it up along the way, if you can bring one thing new to the podcast every day, then it's a success. If you can teach someone or tell someone something they didn't know before listening to the podcast, then I think that podcast is a success.
Right. Brian Kreider writes in, and this is kind of speaks to what we were talking about before about playing the game. You understand how much energy it takes out of you to battle along the boards and corners, just as an example, or how annoying a glove to the face can be. Yeah, it's those little things, those little nuances that you lose if you don't play the game, that when you're watching it, you can understand, you know, not to blame the guy who's taking a 2-minute shift for not being in the right position on a goal. You know, this is the kind of thing that you'll figure out, like, you know. Pete David with a great email here. This is about speaking directly about the Thompson Duncan Keith thing. And this is how I felt about it a little bit, too. She asked him if he deserved a penalty for slashing Daniel Sedin from behind on his breakaway when, A, what Keith did is incredibly common. Every NHL defenseman does that when trying to chase down a breakaway. Right or wrong, a penalty is rarely called. And, B, even if the ref raised his hand to call the late penalty, it would have gone back down immediately as Sedin's goal nullified it. Anyone with even a cursory knowledge of the game would know both of those things and thus know how inane her questions were. Thompson is not bad at her job because she's a woman. She's not bad because she's never played the game. She's bad because she lacks a fundamental understanding of the game, and she's being paid to supposedly report on it. Plenty of people like you understand the game and its many nuances despite never having played at a high level. Saying that someone doesn't know the game because they've never played is a cop-out from both sides. It's a convenient retort from a player who doesn't like a question he's been asked, but it's also too convenient an excuse for someone like Karen Thompson to not put in the time and effort to learn the game. I get that, but I have two reactions to it.
I can't speak to that because I don't know the body of Karen Thompson's work.
That's the thing. It's assuming on her career. But let's just say that she's a novice, but maybe doesn't have the Bob McKenzie in understanding of hockey. Okay, she's there because the storyline that she's following on that line of questioning is Duncan Keith destroyed Daniel Sedin with a check and took him out of the playoffs for the most part. Him slashing Sedin on the back on a breakaway, while pedestrian, you know, as far as a play that you see in every game, it becomes newsworthy based on the players that are involved in the incident.
The history.
Yeah. So I think there is a story there, but what pissed me off, and I didn't get a chance to say this before because we had to get to our guest, what pissed me off about it, and this has been my take since the beginning on this matter, sexism, whatever you want to call it, fine, you can make your case, but here's my basic problem with it. She was dicking around on the question. And as a guy who does this for a living, who's been at hundreds of scrums with athletes of every sport and every nature, she was being cute. And instead of coming out and saying, why did you slash Daniel Sedin on the back? What were you hoping to accomplish? Were you surprised there wasn't a penalty? You know, there was, but maybe she didn't see the arm go up. She asked two questions that didn't mention a slash, and then when Duncan Keith actually said to her, what are you talking about? She said, no, nothing, I'm just checking in. So she's playing, she's dicking around. She's playing coy. So if you're Duncan Keith and you're three questions in and you still have no effing clue what this woman's getting at, then yeah, you're going to get a little pissy. So that was my issue with her line of questioning. His reaction was stupid and it was sexist and it was demeaning, and the you can't play the game thing is the white flag of surrender in a situation like this as a journalist talking to an athlete. But by no means are her hands clean on this one. Her question was stupid. Just come out and ask whether or not you were trying to hurt the guy. Get to the point. This is a guy who just lost a game to their arch rivals, for Christ's sake.
Yeah. Geez, I'm a lot more understanding, I think, in these situations, Wish. There are a lot of and this isn't true of Vancouver, which is a longtime hockey market going back to 1970. But as the NHL grows, there will be new fans that come along with it, and there will also be new reporters that come along with it. There'll also be, you know, new reporters, and this is their first gig, and they're not used to what happens in a scrum. They're not used to talking to an athlete, and sometimes that can
that's
be a
fair.
Little bit intimidating, regardless of whether you're a woman or whether you're a man. So in this situation, again, that's why I come back to, I don't know the full body of Karen Thompson's work, so I can't pass judgment based on one exchange with Duncan Keith. So I'm still prepared to cut her a lot
fair,
of slack. It did take her a while to get to her point and get to her
question. She
never
said the word slash at all. In the entire conversation, she didn't say the word slash once. The problem I have with it, even if you want to play the novice card, and I think you can, you know, it's intimidating to be in a scrum and talk to a guy like Duncan Keith and ask him a difficult question. I get that. I've been there, right? But the premise of the question is difficult. The premise of the question is provocative. You have to expect, after a loss, talking to Duncan Keith about Daniel Sedin and an uncalled penalty, that you're going to get a reaction. She's looking for a reaction, and she got one. And that's, for me, one of the things that hasn't been said enough in this situation.
So much focus
on female referees and everything else that there's no – and that was the problem last night. Please tell me why the Vancouver radio station took the entire conversation out of context and cut off literally 20 seconds of conversation before he got to the female referees thing.
Yeah,
she had like three questions before we got to that part.
Yeah, shouldn't have done that. But I think that – and that comes down to experience as well. I mean, you can look for a reaction, but unless you've been in that situation, and here comes the authenticity card, from a journalist's point of view, unless you've been in that scrum and seen that reaction and dealt with players like that and, you know, 1,000 different times, you don't know how to handle the reaction coming back. Like, you're maybe not prepared for a hostile hockey player to shoot back at you, an angry hockey player to fire something back that you weren't expecting to come back at you, and that's just... That's as you say to any person who starts media, man, it's just time in. It's just time in that you learn how to deal with those types of situations and move on. That's why, you know, Larry Brooks can stand there in front of John Tortorella's face as John Tortorella cuts him down, and all the Brooks he does is make his little notes and keep looking up at John and say, okay, John, you want to keep hanging yourself here. How far do we want to go with this? Or what you saw with Mike Harrington and Ron Rolston last Friday. And that was a nifty little exchange as well, where Rolston lost it on Harrington. And you know what? Good for Harrington for not making it about himself, by the way. Harrington really could have made that about himself, and he chose not to. Good for Mike Harrington.
Do you know, you want to know what my most famous or infamous interview ending question was?
What's that?
Boston, Vancouver, Stanley Cup final. I asked Luongo his reaction based on the remember when he got pulled for Schneider? Well, I know it's happened like
Can you be a little more specific, sir?
I know. There was a viewing party back in Vancouver. Luongo got pulled, and there was a cheer at the viewing party, I believe, for him getting pulled and Schneider coming in. And so I asked him about that, the reaction of the fans back home, and he just kind of like walked away, ended the scrum.
What did he tweet you about last night?
It was going back and forth. I forget what that was. It was going back and forth with Cam Charon and a couple of people about something, but I forget what it was. But
really, because we just finished up Hockey Central. I think it was the 11 o'clock. I can't remember which one it was. And I was checking Twitter, and there's Strombone One tweeting to my boy Greg Wyshynski.
Strombone One and I are cool now. After
you guys are all good now.
Well, yeah, there was the inference that I made in a post recently about him not being the sole author of his Twitter feed. To which Strombone One struck back and stated his case, and I think we're okay now. I think we're boys. Maybe not that I reminded him that I was the asshole who asked the question about the fans cheering his removal from the game, but who knows? Maybe he doesn't listen to the podcast. And if any of you narc on me, I swear to God, I'm going to hunt you down. Jake Ivey, Jake Ivey, not about playing the game, not at all. I taught my wife what to look for during a game, and she knows a lot. Depends on the teacher. Melissa Ronsberg, yes and no. Yes, you can understand it if you don't play, but if you play it, then you understand the game differently and better.
Selena Sachedina, you could watch all the hockey in the world and understand it, but I believe you would learn even more by playing it. Alan Grisak, no, but you need to have some team sport experience. Oh, and baseball doesn't really count.
Oh, man. Joe Pack writes in regarding EA Sports NHL series. I'm a lifelong hockey fan. Lifelong hockey player who learned the game from playing on the ice, but I still have friends who didn't grow up on the ice, and I'm from Toronto, tell me that they picked up things from playing hockey video games, specifically things like gap control, because you don't want to be beaten down the wing as a defenseman, and the confidence to hold on to the puck. Most of us play the video game from a bird's-eye camera perspective, and I have seen friends who have played the EA Sports game and then shown more confidence with the puck because they feel like they have a more nuanced perspective on how much room they have in the ice. I agree. Yeah. I completely agree with that. And I also agree, for football, if you've never played organized football and you've never held a playbook, if you're playing Madden and you're seeing all the plays that those guys run on Madden, you know, the set plays, mm-hmm. and know where the wide receivers are going to be and everything else, like, that's football. Now, granted, it's not getting hit, but it's understanding the playbook. It's understanding how to run an offensive series and how to mix up your plays and things like that. There are things you can glean from video games. And granted, it could be elementary, entry-level cursory stuff, but by no means can you dismiss it. Yeah.
Here's a good one from a guy or a gal. I'm not sure. I think it's a guy. Kyle Cresswell. Let me just check. Kyle? It's a cool ass name. Cresswell. Two words. Ken Hitchcock. That's a great one. You know what Hitch did? He worked at a sporting goods store. Mm-hmm. I think actually in Edmonton. I actually think he sold Kelly Rudy a pair of pads once. And Ken Hitchcock, last time I checked, knew a thing or two about hockey. There's more names we can give out too. You mentioned one. Bob McKenzie. You know, where did Bob McKenzie play his NHL hockey? And another one, to me and many other people, he may be the best color voice.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
Best color voice in the history of the game. Please tell me where Dick Irvin Jr. played. Please tell me the hockey team. Now, I understand that his father was one of the most legendary coaches of all time, but having said that, please tell me where Dick Irvin Jr. played hockey. And he may be the best color man of all time.
Well, then there's also a guy who did play hockey but never at the National Hockey League level, who has 9 Stanley Cups as a coach. William Scotty Bowman.
Oh, yes, of course.
Yes.
He's got 9?
I believe it's 9.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
Hold on. Now you're going to make me. Now, I think that was. All right, hold on. I'm going to Hockey DB.
You might be right, bud. You might be right.
All right, let me see here. 73, 75. 76, 73, 76, 77, 78, 79. That's five.
Yeah.
Pittsburgh, six. Detroit, nine, right? Yeah, that's right.
And then do you count his work with the Blackhawks in 2010?
Well, I guess so. I mean, that's as a coach.
You're just saying as a coach?
Yeah, just as a coach.
Yeah, nine. Wow, he's got that many, eh? I guess Scotty Bowman was kind of good. No one talks about the Buffalo years, though.
No. Two more emails before we head off into the sunset here. Matt Campbell, I've never played hockey at any level. I've been a season ticket holder for the Charlotte Checkers for 11 years now, and I've been to hundreds of games here and elsewhere. I can barely even ice skate without looking like a first-timer, but I guarantee I understand hockey better than the majority of the dickholes that post in the Puck Daddy comments. Sometimes you don't know where these emails are going. That was very funny. I'll say this. If you know where you learned the game? I'll tell you where you learned the game. And this is where I learned the game. In the cheap seats. If you sit upstairs, you learn the game. You see everything. You see line changes. You see stuff behind the play. You see all of the coaching nuance and systems and everything else that happens in the game. If you're paying whatever it is now, $40 for your upper deck ticket, you're seeing it. Versus if you sit downstairs.
I think you learn different things though. I think, by and large, when you sit, and to me, the sweet spot is about 30 rows up. 30, 35 rows up, you probably have the best, like, middle of the ice. It's the best vantage point. What I love about the cheap seats is that's where the real hockey fans are. And not only are you learning by watching, but you're learning by listening, and you're learning by talking as well with the people that are there. But don't you find that, you know, the first time you have a rail seat right along the glass, that you have, you know, all of a sudden, then you learn to appreciate a lot more the speed of the game, how hard the hits are, how quick the decisions you have to make are. Or, interestingly enough, you know what, now that I think about that, that can be deceptive too. Because what's the one thing that players always say? I remember that, Crosby said this when he went out with his concussion. He said, you know, it was the first time in a long time I've had a lot of time not playing hockey, but watching hockey. And he said he learned a lot. He said, you know, when you're on the ice, you think you only have a split second to make a play, but watching from up top, I realize I have a little bit more time than I thought. Because everything is rush, 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 rush on the ice. And I realized after standing back and watching it, because he's always been on the ice, that I have more time than I thought I did when I played the game.
Boy, we had
that can be deceptive.
You almost opened up a hell of a match game moment.
What's that?
Sidney Crosby had a concussion, and I remember when his first reaction was that he had more time for blank.
Oh man, I love match game.
Charles Nelson Riley, I said taping his stick.
The best part about match game was, you know, they would tape them all on a Sunday. And they would tape them on a Sunday afternoon, and they would all start drinking around noon. So by the time the Friday show, that's why Fridays and match game were always the best, because everybody was hammered. Everybody was a pickle in a jar.
Everybody has their litmus test for cool people. That's one for me. Like if you, no matter what your age is, because now they're on Game Show Network, if you understand the match game, if you at least have some cursory knowledge of match game, then we can hang. Finally, Kevin Cronin writes in, it's not necessary to understand the sport on some level, but it's hard to understand the complexities and intricacies without ever lacing them up and picking up a stick. You may be saying to yourself, why on earth would you be reading such a pedestrian email about this subject? Well, that's because he ends it with random penguin, Sirhan, prisoner of the year.
There it is. Winner, Gagnon. Yeah.
That is...
Quickly.
God. Okay. What? Yes, please. Go ahead.
We're going to need Josh to... Mike, Josh, heat up your mic here, for this is a question for you. This comes from Scott Zahn. So is Game Show Friday's theme from an 80s cartoon, or am I having flashbacks of smoking weed and eating Cheerios? What is that theme?
That is a good question.
Do you know what that's called?
Let me just check here. Wilfred Burns' Stopgap is the name of that song.
Ah, okay, very good. There you go.
So finally, Seth
smoking weed.
Seth K from Ohio puts the cherry on the sundae. To me, how can you understand Match Game if you've never been on it? One day I will be on it. There's two game shows that Merrick and I will do at a party at some point, either yes. Family Feud or a Match Game.
It's true.
You got to do it. We'll eventually get to this party that we've been dying to have. All right, with that, that's the end of the show. A little bit of overtime. A great friggin' show today. Thanks to Helena St. James for joining us to talk about the Red Wings and this Duncan Keith nonsense. I am Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet tonight, working Hockey Central with John Shannon. Big games tonight, folks. Winnipeg Jets, Washington Capitals. What do you think happens there, Greg Wyshynski?
Funny you should mention that game, Jeff Merrick, because I will be at that game tonight, and I have a feeling the Capitals are going to close this thing out.
I'm a fancy
guy. I was so sad to see. Well, first of all, Pavlik kept them in that game against Buffalo in the third period, and I was also very sad to see Wellwood go out with an injury. He was in beast mode this weekend in that game, and really hated to see him go out. But I have a feeling the Caps are going to win this game and may win it emphatically. Don't forget, folks, 12-1 outscoring the Jets in their last three games. So have their number.
It was that back-to-back and that quirk of the schedule, both games at MTS. And those are the two games that turned the Washington Capitals season around, wasn't it?
And wouldn't it
be poetry,
that
was the moment
then?
They said, that's it, attach the Rockets to the back and we're going to the playoffs.
Wouldn't it also be poetry tonight, then, if they get the clincheroo against the Jets?
Rangers need this one against the Florida Panthers. They need to win against the Florida Panthers tonight. Also, the Dallas Stars need to win out tonight to face off against the San Jose Sharks. Last game on the sched this evening. Los Angeles and Minnesota. Minnesota could fall out, but I don't think they will. They got Edmonton and Colorado still, but Los Angeles on tap tonight for the Wild. So some pretty big games tonight.
Don't sleep on that. And don't sleep on, as much as I don't think it'll happen, and we were going to talk about this a little bit today. We got caught up on other stuff. I don't think it's going to happen, but there is no X next to that O in Ottawa. Again, three games left.
Yay!
Only two for Winnipeg. But those three games, Washington, Philly, Boston.
Yeah, I know.
Listen, I don't think it's going to happen. I think they're getting in. I hope they're getting in because I talked about them in that dopey video thing we did this week. But that said, no X next to that name yet.
They spent the whole – and it wasn't just Chris. The team just seemed transfixed on running at Matt Cook yesterday.
Yep.
Next thing you know, Dustin Jeffrey turns into a beast. And so did Brendan Morrow. I'm sorry, but Morrow's been awesome for that team.
Yeah. Well, that's probably because Matt Cook made fun of their penises, too.
Probably.
Congratulations to Don Brennan. You've done a great service to your newspaper, sir. All right. Anyways, that is the show for today. Very journalism-centric show. I like that. A couple days now this week have gone real journo-centric. That's it. We'll talk to you tomorrow. And have a great night, everybody. Bye.